You're listening live to Right Side Radio with Phil Williams. It's hard to go wrong when you're on the right side. Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right.
Happy Friday, everybody. I am not Phil Williams. I'm Scott Buttram from the Trustful Tribune, sitting in for Phil while he takes a little bit of a break. We're going to get right to our first guest today, Representative Danny Garrett from Trustful. Representative Garrett, also a very good friend, in fact, a good enough friend that I could reach out to at the last minute and say, hey, I need you on the radio show. And he always agrees to come on. Danny, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing well. Let's touch on just kind of one quick update in terms of the redistricting coming out of the special session and the map that was approved ultimately. And tell me where that stands, how you feel about that, and just kind of give our listeners a little clarification on our current situation there.
Well, I think there's a misunderstanding from a lot of people that the Supreme Court made the determination that Alabama had to have two majority-minority districts.
Correct.
That's really not what the ruling said.
That's right.
It basically said that they had to have a district where the minority minorities had a significant opportunity to elect someone from their party. And so what the House did in our bill that we passed, our redistricting plan, was to take District 2 from about 29% minority to about 42% minority. And the Senate, in their bill, had taken that percentage to 38%, and we settled at 40%. So what you have is a district that's 40% minority by terms of ethnicity and race.
Mm-hmm.
So you can make assumptions, and there's data that shows how much of that population typically votes Democratic, and then also how much of the Caucasian population votes Democratic. That district, though, that's been presented includes entirety of Montgomery County, including the city of Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, the lower that number, I think the more at risk that the courts may not determine that was sufficient. Obviously, we felt like the House 42% number was something that would be accepted by the courts. I think we're at a point now where it could go either way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hearing both things. What we really don't want to happen is for the courts to draw the districts. So I think that the plan we put forth has the most compactness of any plan. I think it's a very defensible. The AG's office certainly feels like it's defensible and feels like it's a good plan. And we're going to hope for the best. But I think it's honestly right there on the bar where it could go either way, depending upon how the courts interpret. That's an important note, too, that what was initially presented by the legislature back in the regular session was something that had been approved by the Obama administration.
You're right.
So there's a lot of mixed signals coming out of D.C. and, political things going on. So
right.
We'll see. But I think it's defensible.
I think my feeling all along was it almost didn't matter what you were going to do, because I just look back at the language used by the judges when the whole thing started. I think they're chomping at the bits to take it and do it themselves anyway, but that's nothing but speculation on my part. So, but you guys got it done, and we've got one in front of the court, so now we just wait to hear, right?
Right, right.
Let's move on to a topic that I believe it was about a year ago on this show, Danny, when I was filling in and once again drug you in to help me get through the afternoon. But you made the comment early on, well before the last session. We were talking about school choice, and you made the comment on this show you believed school choice was inevitable. We've seen that issue grow. We've seen it come up and come down in the last session. We saw the Price Act offered. We saw – actually, I'm going to include two different bills that you sponsored, that you put out. One, I think, followed – was it the Utah model?
Right. Yes. Okay. Legislation similar to what Utah
passed. And another bill that we haven't talked a lot about that you put up, and it didn't get out of committee, but it was giving school systems the option to go to year-round school, which I think would be a very legitimate additional school choice option for a lot of families, a lot of folks. That was discussed heavily back in the late 80s and 90s and was a model a lot of people were having success with. Now the governor has come out, and she's been, you know, I think she gave it a little lip service in her State of the State address, but didn't really come out strongly during the session in terms of wanting full school choice. But now she's come out and said she wants Alabama to be the leader in school choice. That turn of events coming out of the governor's office, can you make a prediction on what you see coming in that regard in the next session?
You know, the next thing on my agenda, I've been pretty busy, was actually to call the governor's office to find out really kind of what they've got in mind. I actually had two school choice bills, well, actually three, but two were, one was modeled after Utah. So it was a universal choice bill modeled after Utah.
Right.
I also had a bill that actually passed out of the committee. I believe it passed the House, actually, was the Sun Act, which was a bill that would allow for school choice for students with unique needs,
right,
including the special needs population and other students. Other states are doing that. That actually passed the House and got tangled up in the Senate. But I think those were the two school choice bills, in addition to the year-round bill. And what I did there was, you know, we don't really operate on the agrarian calendar anymore, you know, for
right,
most of our careers. And that's kind of how our school system initially came about.
Wait, your kids, are you telling me your kids don't harvest the crops?
they don't. Some do.
Put them in the fields for the summer?
I have not done that. But, you know, but the workforce today is a different deal. And of course, you know, now you've got a situation where two parents are working and things like that. So child care is a problem, transportation is a problem, keeping kids engaged, you know, through that summer lull, and also the learning cap you see.
Right.
So what we've seen around the country is that systems have gone, particularly in some of these high poverty areas or these inner city areas, where they've modified the calendar to keep the kids engaged more throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
And the bill I offered up was going to basically allow schools the opportunity to do that. And so what would have happened, just for an example, you could do it a number of different ways, but one approach that's worked well in Mississippi is working well would be that, you know, you would go 9 weeks and then have 3 week break, 9 weeks, 3 week break, 9 weeks, 3 week break. Now that 3 week break, two of those weeks, the child could still come to school. The school would be open, and during that 2 weeks, could be used for remediation, for tutoring,
right,
for special, you know, training type things.
Enrichment classes.
Don't need that,
a lot of stuff.
If you don't need that, you could be in enrichment or doing things like that. And then there'd be one hard break, you know. And of course, the teachers during that 2 week time would be voluntary situation, but they would be, you know, compensated accordingly. It would be voluntary on that part of the parents, but it would allow you to go and keep the children engaged longer and have remediation and tutoring throughout the year for those that need it.
Right.
And then in the summer, you would still have a significant break, probably 6 weeks or so would be off in the summer. But, you know, the kids are engaged longer.
Right.
Now, that, I think, was a good bill and makes a lot of sense. But I'll just tell you that when I filed it, to make that calendar work that I just described to you, you have to extend the number of days you can go to school.
Right.
So this was, the headline came out in AL.com that legislator filed bill to extend school year by 30 days.
I saw
it. Everybody in the state said, wait a minute, whoa. That wasn't the point, you know. So I said, okay, we'll regroup on that one, try to do a better job getting out in front of it. But that's just another option. Of course, we did modify the Accountability Act and do other things.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the governor's got in mind. I want to find out. But I think that clearly, you know, if there's a national wave of this, we're seeing more and more of it.
Mm-hmm.
Really, you know, demand from people within the state. And I think people also are still trying to understand what it is and what it's not. One thing, though, that I think is really pushing people to get to that point where they're really even open to it is the, I'll use the term, you're not supposed to use anymore, the woke term, but I mean woke, the crazy stuff.
It is.
That's just beyond the pale. And people pretty much, I think, just said, you know what, that's enough, you know. And so I think that, and if the public schools don't get in front of those issues and don't get a grip on the safety issues in public schools, you're going to see a mass exodus from the public schools. And of course, we don't want that. We want to have good public education. But we've got to deal with these other issues, and clearly we're not getting the help out of D.C. They're actually going the other direction. So it's incumbent upon the states to step up, and I think Alabama is ready to do that, and look forward to seeing where we move.
I want to point out to our listeners who probably aren't aware of this, but before Representative Garrett ran for the State House, he served on the Trustful City School Board of Education. He was one of our board members there. Danny, I think that gives you a little bit more of a unique perspective maybe than the average legislator, because you have sat in that chair. You just mentioned some of the – and I'm like you. I don't have a better term than woke, and everybody knows what we're talking about when we say that. So as we see some of these bizarre decisions come out of Washington – virtually all of our public schools are accepting federal funds, which makes them somewhat beholden to what the federal government wants to happen within these schools. How problematic do you see that if we continue in the direction we're going in Washington right now?
Well, I think that's true. There are strings attached to a lot of the money. But I think one of the other things, too, that I'm just going to bring it closer to home, and this is one thing I've talked to the governor's office about and to our leadership about, mm-hmm. and the fact that there's so many of these boards that we have in the state. You know, we have Republican supermajorities. We have Republican executive branch, and we make appointments to all these boards. And yet a lot of this stuff slips through. You know, one of the bills I've sponsored this past session was a modification to the literacy
task
force.
That's right. That's right.
Because what we found out was that there was curriculum that was coming into the schools that was not being reviewed by any textbook committee, and that curriculum that was into the schools was not age-appropriate and had a lot of questionable material and got into ideologies that are just not mainstream.
Right.
And that was because of the way the task force had been set up. And I think one fundamental issue we've got is that when we have, you know, when we appoint these task forces, you know, most of these people have full-time jobs. They're not, you know, they're doing this gratis, you know, and they're doing it on their free time. And they're getting recommendations from these national organizations. There was a time when you could trust the National Education Association.
Yeah.
There was a time when you could trust the National Library Association. There was a time when you could trust some of these you know, institutions, and you can't anymore because they've gone crazy. And so what happens is when you get these task force of well-meaning people appointed by conservatives who are basically saying, well, here we had this issue in the state school board. Actually, we got in front of it and they pulled it, but there was some guidelines for exemplary libraries that the librarians of the public schools, and some of them are, I know some of them, they're very conservative.
Yeah, yeah, I do too.
God-fearing people, and they signed off on some recommendations that really, when you got behind the recommendations, it was going to be a pathway for some of this crazy stuff.
Right.
So I think that we've got to do a better job vetting this national material, vetting the things we allow the public schools to come into. You're right, some of the federal, some of the funding restricts some things, but I think most of it is just the fact that we're not being aware enough to vet some of these things and just say, you know what, we're not going that direction.
Yeah, and we should point out, you caught a lot of flack for trying to make or for making changes in the Literacy Act kind of last minute. I believe AL.com was one of the ones that kind of called you to task and slanted that in such a way that it made it look like you were trying to change things. I don't know what their insinuation was, to be
honest.
It
looked like I was trying to lower the standards and lower the bar.
And you were actually adding accountability that did not exist in the bill.
Yeah, we had set up a task force that was answerable to nobody, accountable to nobody.
Right.
And by their own admission, as we started looking at, you know, my question was pointed out, as some of this material began to hit some of these elementary classrooms.
Yeah.
They would say, well, we didn't look at that. Our task was not to look at the curriculum. We were to look, did the material meet the science of reading, which
right.
is what the Literacy Task Force was all about. And I support all of that. But the problem is, of course, I don't know how you can approve a curriculum when you don't read it, but they didn't. So it's stuff like that we just got to, I think we can control, we can get in front of, and we can fix. And I think that you're going to – I think see a concerted effort from the legislature to push more quality and more diligence and things like that. Because I'm telling you, Scott, a lot of what's happening is people are taking what they think are good recommendations from what we think are reputable organizations. And I'm just telling you, that stuff is a lot of that stuff is toxic.
It'll hit you in the back. Danny, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it very much. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Welcome back to Right Side Radio, always right, and the guy who's always right is going to join us soon. That is Jeff Poor from The Jeff Poor Show. He'll be with us momentarily. You probably heard from Jeff all day yesterday on this show. He was the fill-in for Phil Williams. I'm Scott Buttram from the Trussell Tribune. I'm filling in today. Hey, just want to remind you guys, I filled in several times. They keep telling me that we've got a phone line, 833-687-448. That you can phone in your calls, your questions, or you can text us your comments. I didn't believe them. I didn't think this thing was actually operational because every time I fill in, ruffians, you do not help me out. You do not call. You do not give questions. You can actually help me out by doing that and giving me more stuff to talk about so I don't talk about the same thing over and over and become redundant as I'm apt to do quite often. But I wandered in here on Phil and Boomer one day in the middle of their show and realized all this stuff does actually work. Phil actually gets text messages from you ruffians. He actually gets phone calls from you guys. Y'all interact with the show, but not when the substitute teacher's here. When the substitute teacher's here, everybody is sitting at the back of the room talking among yourselves when you're not helping me out. So let me give you that number again, 833-687-4448. You can call or text, and I would appreciate it if you would. It'd give me a little more to do and a little more to talk about. So do it the way you do it when the real teacher is here. Help out. Call in. Let me know that you're out there listening and we've got stuff to talk about. You just heard from Representative Danny Garrett, covered a couple of things. We talked a little bit about the redistricting. It is now headed to the courts. It'll be in their hands. And we talked a lot about the school choice issue here in the state of Alabama. The governor has now gotten on board and gotten on board pretty vocally and in a strong way. Danny Garrett, Representative Garrett, told us on this show when I filled in for Phil about a year ago, he thought it was inevitable. He put forward three bills in the last session that he was telling us about. So we think we're going to see some action on this coming in. We did not mention in the interview, you guys are aware of it because you keep up with news. The Lieutenant Governor, Will Ainsworth, has been extremely vocal in support of full school choice for the state of Alabama as the federal government pushes down on public schools, sends them directives that do not fall in line with the average people or the average person in Alabama. I think we're going to see more and more people interested in school choice. We'll always be keeping an eye on that. It is grounded in conservative principles. I would just remind you of that. So as a conservative state, it's something we should all want to see and want to see very soon. We are headed to our bottom of the hour break. When we come back, Jeff Poor of the Jeff Poor Radio Show will be joining us. We've got Boomer on the other side of the mic trying his best to keep me in the middle of the road. I don't know if he's going to be successful, but y'all know the boy's trying. He's doing his best. You stay with us and come back and join us on the other side of this break. Welcome back to Right Side Radio. This is Scott Buttram from the Trussell Tribune. Hey, a quick shout-out back to Allison. Thank you for making me feel welcome, Allison, and letting me know there is somebody out there listening. We appreciate that. And also to Brian over in Huntsville. Brian, Boomer Brian seems to think that the White House should hire you. that you could keep them straight. You're that good.
I don't know about that. Not right now, at least.
Brian, I can tell you right now, if the White House comes, we're putting up a fight. We're not letting Boomer go anywhere easily. Joining us now, my good friend and a great radio talk show host himself, one of the great conservative voices in Alabama, Jeff Poor of The Jeff Poor Show. Jeff, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing well. It's good to be back after 24 hours or 22 hours.
Well, this is for the audience members that just can't get enough Jeff Poor.
You know, this is my third appearance on Right Side Radio in 4 days. Well, wait, no, that's not right. My fourth appearance in 5 days.
Fourth in 5 days. Well, that's interesting. I had a very long and drawn out and in-depth conversation with Paul DeMarco last night, who is the political writer for my newspaper, by the way, and struggled to get him to come on as a guest because he had been on your show, he had been on Phil's show. He was so worried that he would step on himself coming on as a guest today. I had to convince him it'd be okay.
Well, you know what? I didn't even think of that because I should have assumed you were going to have him today. I should have looked elsewhere. I had a few good guests yesterday, I think.
Well, the one thing I learned from you is don't worry about being redundant on radio because the audience is coming and going. So
yeah,
I actually used that line on Paul last night and got him to come on. So we're good.
How many times have you listened to an entire 3-hour radio show in your life?
I would never do that. In fact, I will say the longest I spend listening to the radio these days, I'm either listening to you or I'm listening to Phil Williams, one of the two of you online. That gets my most radio attention. And no offense to either of you, but 20 minutes is about all I can go.
Yeah, I understand that. I mean, like, I used to listen to like Rush Limbaugh, maybe the whole show.
Yeah.
But that I mean, that's why he was, you know, Rush Limbaugh.
Right, right.
But this is what I learned from Del Jackson, who typically mails it in when it comes to radio. Oh, don't worry about repeating yourself. No one's listening to your whole show. Who cares? And then just have like two opinions and just repeat them for 3 hours.
Well, he's the most trusted guy in radio. We know that. If Dale said
well,
it, it's got
to
be
you
true.
You don't have to have but two opinions all day. Then you can be trusted.
Well, you've got to understand, Jeff, he can't concentrate a lot on the radio show because he's got to make the videos for Yellowhammer News. Speaking of which, does Paul Sashe keep him on or does he let Dale go? How does that work out?
I think Dell's their coveted asset, and I imagine how pathetic that is. But
wow.
Dale, now I understand that they are hoping he continues to bless them with his presence.
Well, he is an asset to them, and
I think that's a stretch. But
it hadn't been the best 3 years, the last 3 years for Yellowhammer News, so Dale was kind of the highlight. But I think I like Paul. I think Paul's very insightful of the conservative audience in Alabama. So I think that he'll give it some direction. And you know, if I'm them, I'm probably naming Dale CEO and just telling him, look, we're just going to mic you up 24 hours a day.
You don't know of this evil that you are speaking here. I don't think you are. Full, I mean, so I those listening on WVNN may remember me from the WVNN Jeff Poor Show era. Dale used to be my boss. I just wouldn't wish it on anybody.
That just thinking of you working for Dale. It sounds more like a pitch for a sitcom to me.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. I can't say that he was a bad boss. The one time we had a big disagreement. So Dale likes gimmicks. Dale loves radio gimmicks, and I just think they're contrived and kind of like, man, so phony. I can't bring myself to it. And Dale used to do this Bracket of Hate, which was just
Bracket
a ripoff
of
another radio station's like Biggest Jerk or something bracket. And I said, I'm not doing this. This is stupid. And he's like, yes, you will. And I'm like, no. And I like didn't do it. And then he told me he was going to fire me if I didn't do it. So I wound up doing it. And then like about 2 months later, I left to go to Mobile.
Yeah, well, that was probably a good career move on your part. Things have worked out pretty well.
I like giving you some inside baseball about WVNN here. But see, like Dale and I are still like friends, and we have a good like Abbott and Costello kind of shtick. I don't understand it, but it sounds like we just absolutely hate each other, but like we're probably really good friends.
Yeah, and we're all that way. Dell and I have gotten into it online, but I do consider him a friend and agree with a lot of what he says, but not always, and he takes objection to that. You know, talking about the jerk category or bracket or whatever you guys did, we did a podcast briefly at the Trussell Tribune, and I got pulled in by my podcast partner, got pulled into a picking winners and losers over a local city issue, which turned out to be a horrible idea. Didn't feel good about it when it happened, did feel good about it when it was finished, and we ended the podcast after that show, as a matter of fact. But I think we're always best to deliver the facts and let our audience figure it out on their own.
Well, so, like, everybody has their own style of radio, but, like, if you listen to Dale Jackson's radio show, he does 7 things you must be talking about today. It's Heat at 8! And he does, like, these, like, contrived, like, segments, which I find absolutely tedious. I mean, that's, like, FM talk radio, like election Terry, or morning and afternoon drive time idiot radio. I can't do it. It drives me crazy.
Yeah.
But that's like he lives on that stuff. And so that means like a big contrast between the two of us.
Well, he's the Rick and Bubba politics. I mean, we should just.
he would hate you saying that. Like, he got in a.
Exactly why I said it.
Oh, Rick Burgess and Dale Jackson have had a feud or two in the past.
I would not be surprised by that at all. Hey, I while we've got you on here, there is something of substance I want to talk to you about. We've got Erica Huddleston. Is she going by Thomas or Huddleston now?
I think your byline's still Thomas, maybe, and then at like the book club, it's Huddleston. I don't know.
Okay. Editor at large at 1819 News, Erica Huddleston Thomas. Had actually a very interesting story, I think she posted yesterday, about this voter fraud trial going on, I believe, in Michigan. And Doug Jones' campaign has popped up in some of the records quite prominently. He spent $1.6 million with this group.
By far and away, the biggest recipient of Doug Jones of cash was that was their biggest customer.
Wow.
Of this company. I mean, I more you look at this, how much did Roy Moore get screwed out of the United States Senate?
Yeah, that was something. I looked at the dates Erica included in that article, and so I went back to take a look. The first payment started right before his election with Roy Moore, and so and that was a tight election because so many people stayed at home.
Well, the way it works, Scott, is that Doug Jones probably exhausted his money, but once you're a United States senator, it's not hard to raise money.
Right. More should come.
And he's up there doing fundraisers, paying off campaign debt. And, I mean, so that's you know, people think, oh, okay, well, you got to raise a bunch of money and you got to have it banked for your campaign. No, not necessarily. You could spend yourself into debt.
Right.
And need to figure out ways to pay your way out of it.
That's exactly right. And on state races, don't they just have like a 30-day window to raise money to retire debt?
That I don't know. I know that this is how AEA has made its way, though, is, hey, you're now a representative. Need some help that campaign debt? And there you have it.
Right. We'll bail you out, which is one of the things that raised a lot of eyebrows with the Sigelman Scrushy deal, that after Sigelman was in office, Scrushy dumps $500,000 on him in campaign contributions that he didn't really need, except he had dropped about $1 million of his own trying to push through the lottery bill
that didn't pass.
And so he did have a lot of personal money to pay off. That probably is what sent both of them to prison, actually.
Yeah, I like Don Sigelman now.
Yeah.
At the time, I was not a Don Sigelman fan, but now I think prison life humbled him some. But, like, looking at that prosecution, and you and I are not, you know, left-wing conspirators here, but they threw the book at those two. They needed to make an example out of those two.
Yeah, and let's remember, Scrushy had just walked from a huge fraud trial involving HelpSouth. He hired the right attorneys. They put on the right dog and pony show in court, and a Birmingham or Jefferson County jury acquitted him, lets him go. And that, I think that was very disturbing to prosecutors who kind of O.J. Simpsoned him. They just came back and hit him on something else and got him the second time around.
Yeah, so it's like, I don't know how y'all feel about that, and well, he got what was coming to him, but that's not the way the justice system's designed. And I just, they got what they wanted to out of those two, but especially with Siegelman. But especially when the U.S. attorney is like Bill Canary's wife or whatever,
right.
Or Laura Canary. You remember? I mean, it was just like, I'm not saying that. I need to make a policy. They played fast and loose, and they got what was coming to them, I guess. But they definitely said, hey, let's get the max on these guys. Whereas if it had been somebody else, they probably wouldn't have pursued it as hard.
I think you're right about that. And, you know, I think it's another example of the pendulum swinging to extremes. It's everything's okay in the state or the country as long as the pendulum stays within certain parameters. But when it takes that wild swing, it triggers reaction and alternate reactions. And I'm going back now to Guy Hunt. Who the Republican governor that wasn't supposed to be there, Democrat Bill Baxley and Bill Baxley and who was it? Beasley. Wasn't Beasley? Who's Baxley? Graddick. Baxley and Graddick.
Charlie Graddick was supposed to be the nominee, and they took it away from him, and they gave it to Baxley.
Right. They implode.
And that paved away. 86 was a weird year in Alabama politics because you know what else happened? So Jeremiah Denton got beat Richard Shelby.
Democrat Richard Shelby.
You had a Democrat winning a U.S. Senate seat over a Republican, but you had a Republican winning the gubernatorial election over a Democrat.
Right. Democrat self-destructed.
This had to be pretty straight ticket. So you don't have the problems you have now. You get an R next to your name, you're going to win. Get a D next to your name, you're going to win. But, I mean— Alabama's a Republican. I don't think the straight ticket stuff matters as much. But back then, it didn't, you know?
Well, they did. I will say this about Guy Hunt. They didn't send him to prison. They did send Siegelman to prison and Scrooge to prison, but they didn't send Hunt to prison. But that was the first political case to get a guy out of office. They wanted
the
to
AG there, Evans or whatever. Jimmy Evans, they were just trying to. They did not like that guy. He was not exactly a guy that used a lot of soaring rhetoric and spoke eloquently.
No.
they were just looking to go after Mr. Polly Pond there.
He spoke exactly as you would expect an Amway salesman / lay preacher to speak. He sounded like that guy every time he spoke. But, you know, that started it. They took him out. They came back and later took Siegelman. Siegelman was actually out of office, but they made sure he would not return. By sending him to prison. So that it's just Alabama politics has never been dull. Down to killing candidates in Phoenix City, Alabama, to George Wallace, to Don Siegelman. Never a dull moment in Alabama politics.
Well, I would agree with that. There's a lot of fast and loose going on with Alabama politics, especially back then. We were going through that transition, right? And the transition probably started in 1980, and it took 20 years, all the way to 30 years, all the way to 2010. But it was really tumultuous 30 years as the parties were sort of shifting in Alabama.
It was. The Reagan Revolution of 80 really woke up Alabama voters to start not voting Democrat Party anymore. They started looking across the aisle and realizing, yeah, we're probably more like Reagan than Jimmy Carter. At least we'd like to believe we are. But here we are, Jeff, in the 21st century, quarter way through the 21st century almost. And we've got a governor, Republican governor, 60-70% approval rating, who has brought the largest gas tax to Alabama in generations. She was not pushing for school choice until she was pushing for school choice. And the conservative voters of Alabama love her. So I've never quite been able to figure out my friends and neighbors here.
I don't know if they love her. I just anyway. Don't you need to get a break here?
I don't know. I'm looking over there. Boomer. He's giving me a nod. We could do that. Let's take a break. Hey, will you stay around and stay with us till the top of the hour?
Sure.
Thanks, Jeff. We'll be right back. This is Right Side Radio. Boomer gave you a fake countdown. Welcome back to Right Side Radio. I'm Scott Buttram, filling in for Phil Williams. On the line with us is Jeff Poore. Jeff has hung around to help us work through these last 2 minutes. And Jeff, you see now why I need all the help I can get when I'm on here. Boomer, he needs an assistant just to keep me straight.
It's a hard trade. I don't know why the Phil Williams approach to bumper music is. I don't see how. Everybody has their own way of working things. It was awkward for me yesterday too. So I've been doing this for 5 years, not that long, but don't feel bad.
Well, I brag all the time. I like Boomer, and his is more instrumental, but it's there's a high level of familiarity for me, so I really like that music. I love your bumper music. You've got Waylon extensively in your rotation, which is like one of my favorite of all time, next to Elvis. I mean, Waylon Jennings and Elvis, that would be my dream concert.
Well, I got some Elvis in there too. I have freshened up my bumper list in the last few days.
There you go. Hey, we've got about 2 minutes to go, Jeff. So, from your perspective, with the news gathering going on at 1819 News, with your knowledge and conversations that you have with Alabama politicos on an ongoing basis, tell our listeners what is the next big story they should be listening for and watching for.
Are they going to let the governor borrow $1 billion bonded over 20 years of gas tax revenue to build this highway in West Alabama? Essentially, if you're driving north from Mobile, it's Highway 43 goes due north. 65 kind of goes to the northeast, but
right.
Due north is 43. You get to Clark County, Thomasville. It's a two-lane road. To a place called Greensboro, and then it connects to 2059 and on in Tuscaloosa. They want to build a road that's going to make it four lane from Tuscaloosa to Mobile. It's going to cost $1 billion. Governor Ivey wants it done before she leaves office, so she's going to bond it, because if she tries to get a federal matching, that will take too long, and if she tries to leave it for the next governor will cancel it because it's a pointless project. So watch this. Watch this close and see if these lawmakers are going to try to stop her from doing it.
In Governor Ivey's defense, this would be the only major highway going to Fonsdale, Alabama.
I don't think it gets quite to Fonsdale. It gets somewhere between Demopolis and Fonsdale. So,
if it doesn't get to Fonsdale, everything's off the table for me.
Those who want to go to the burnt down Fonsdale.
Yeah, it's
grill,
gone.
I mean,
it was tornadoed, by the way. I don't think it burned. I think it was tornadoed.
It did burn. The kitchen burned.
Oh, did it?
The kitchen burned down. Yes. Yes. You're talking to the. I got my Fonsdale T-shirt on over here.
Do you really? I had a very good friend in Trustville that went over for a big fundraiser concert that they had. Oh gosh, it hadn't been that long ago—six, 8 months.
But he used to do the old. Were you around when they were doing the crawfish boil there?
Yes, absolutely.
It was
absolutely.
A big deal. Yeah,
they did it.
Because it's at Auburn. We'd go over there for that.
Well, they did it almost every year at the same time as the A-Day game, and which you didn't, you know, before Saban, nobody came to A-Day games. But it was so funny. Like 5 minutes before halftime. Half the crowd gets up and walks out of the stadium, and they're all going to Fonsdale for the crawfish boil.
Yeah, like the first place that they served me illegally booze, alcohol, and I did not look 21, it was Fonsdale, Alabama.
Hey, Jeff, we're going to take a break. Thank you so much for joining us. Always appreciate everything you bring in. When you guys come back, we are going to go to the text that you've been sending in and talk a little about that. John Paul, I got some stuff to talk to you about. I'll be back after this break. Y'all stay with us.